obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Woo! A drunk from Brooklyn. Woo! Talk about beyond your wildest dreams. First and foremost, I want to thank the committee, because I am honored and humbled to stand before you to share my experience, strength, and hope on why I have a seat in this fellowship. And I'm going to tell you that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I say so. And I'm going to tell you what being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous looks like to me. It looks like I attend meetings. I do service. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. I give back what was so freely given to me. And that gives me the right to call myself a member. And I ask all of you, are you a member?
Yes.
Yay. Then you're in the right place. Again, I want to thank the committee. I'm honored. I'm humble. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So, I grew up in Brooklyn. I don't know what gave it away. My hair, maybe my shoes. And there was a time that I wouldn't tell you, I would tell you I was from Brooklyn. Like that, because I was embarrassed by that. And now I'm very proud of it because it's part of who I am. And I don't want to get anybody nervous, but I got to tell you right up front, my family is the CIA. That's Catholic Irish Alcoholics. I'm going to tell you the extent of Catholic was my mother. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, you goddamn kids. That made us Catholic. Irish, my mother's last name was Duffy. She had 13 brothers and sisters. If you took a family portrait, they all had red hair, freckles, blue eyes, skinny legs, and beer bellies. They were Irish. Everybody looked that way in Brooklyn. And alcoholics, that they were. You know, but I didn't know that then. I'm going to speak with a language now that I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Trust me when I tell you I didn't have that language when I was out there. There were words I learned here that I don't think I ever used in the 37 years before I got here. So I grew up in a six-family house on 538 Union Avenue. And I'm going to tell you, to the left of my house was a lot, an empty lot, which half of it was used for a parking lot for, as my mother would say, the factory across the street. And the other part was used to store large pipes and things that they used at this factory. On this side, whether this is the right, so to the right of me. To the left of me was a junkyard. Okay, across the street was a lumber yard, and across the street this way was a Catholic church and school. So, in the empty lot at night, all the stray cats in the neighborhood gathered as they were in heat. So that's what I heard, the wailing of cats. There were junkyard dogs in the junkyard next door who used to get very excited hearing the cats in heat, and they barked all night. Okay, the lumber yard, I was just surrounded by a lot of wood. Okay, maybe you guys can identify with that. Okay, now across the street is the Catholic Church, Our Lady of Mount Carmel, and I had a street light. So every night, Jesus stared in my window. So you want to talk about PTSD? Okay, and this is what it was like for me. Now, I'll tell you, we lived on the first floor, on the left. On the right lived Annie, the Avon lady. Upstairs lived Aunt Mitzi and Uncle Henry. And next to her was Uncle Joe and Aunt Mary. And above them was Aunt Eileen and Uncle Al. And next to them was Uncle Raymond. Okay, I later found out that none of them were my blood relatives. I really thought that they were my family. But I found out that my mother drank. I have no right to call my mother an alcoholic, but my mother drank, and she drank a lot. If that qualifies her as an alcoholic, that's not for me to say. And she's in her resting place now. And I want to say happy birthday, Mom, because today's her birthday. And, of course, I'd be speaking at the AALA Roundup today on her birthday. And she passed away 2.5 years ago, same day as Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, so Mom, anybody Mom drank and drugged with became my aunt and uncle. So I want you to know, like, I had a large family. And, you know, I became powerless over alcohol very young. See, but I say that to you now because but I had no idea to never use the word powerless before I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at about 5 years old, I kind of figured out how my mother was when she drank. And if she had, you know, like a six-pack, I was the prettiest little girl. And she just loved me, and she played with my hair, and she just told me how cute I was. And then when she was on to the second six-pack, you know, I wasn't as cute anymore. She bossed me around, pushed me a little hard, and by time into the case, towards the end of the case of beer, I wasn't pretty at all. And she was resentful that she had me. And let me know that. And I used to hide. And I hid a lot. You know, and you know, as I was growing up, you know, I was always looking for something. I don't know what I was looking for, but as I got into recovery, and you do this work, you find out that, like, something was always missing. You were always chasing something. You know, and things were always missing in my childhood. You know, like, if we had peanut butter, we didn't have bread. You know, if we had cereal, we didn't have milk. You know, if we had eggs, I didn't have butter. You know, so like I wondered, like, you know, something was always missing. You know, and I could never understand why. You know, and I promised that I would never drink. I made a promise that I would never drink because I was cleaning up the messes of alcohol from the age of 5 years old on. When I tell you cleaning up the mess, the cops came to my house all the time. My father had a stuttering problem. If I tell you, I never understood a word my father said. Never understood a word he said. I could tell you that his name was George. He smoked Marlboro. He wore them in his sleeve, rolled up like a Jimmy Dean in his T-shirt. My mother's name is Beatrice. She smoked Viceroy, and she wore them in her bra. You know, this is the way we grew up. Beach chairs on the concrete outside the house, cases of beer, and the fire hydrant on to cool off. So, you know, this is how we grew up, and it was great. And I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there, boy. Okay, so, you know, I promised I wouldn't drink. Okay, and, you know, I don't know if anybody here has ever promised that they wouldn't drink. Well, hence... you're in AA, okay? So, you know, so I promised that I would never drink. I despised alcohol. I despised the taste of it. I despised everything about it. So now, you know, I want to give you a little theme of how things went for me. So my first I want to tell you my sober date is October 31st, 1999. Okay, I'm sober by the grace of God 15 years. Not a first-time wonder, didn't come in and stay. That's not my story. I had to go back out a couple of more times. Okay, my home group is Gift of Serenity, Franklin Square, New York. And I say that because it just feels good to know that I have a sober date, that I have a day that my journey began, and that I have a place that I call home. But I'm also going to tell you right now, my home group is the AALA Roundup right now. Because wherever I am, that's my home group. So thank you. So, you know, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you a little theme of how things went, because I don't like to talk a whole lot about me, and people that attend my workshop, I think they might get that, because I don't talk about the story. Because, you see, when I talk about me, I'm talking about the problem, because I was the problem. And I live in the solution today, so I'm not the solution. And someone did say yesterday something that was very profound. I have good news, I have bad news. There is a solution. That's the good news. The bad news is you're it. And someone said that in a workshop yesterday. And you know what? We'll never, never have too many 24s to learn something. And yes, I can be the solution. But I can also be the problem. So I have to remember that. So I'm going to tell you how it began for me. Okay, in 1973, I kissed a girl. There's a song, right, about that? In 1973, I kissed a girl, so I drank. Okay, in 1974, I kissed a boy. I drank and drugged. Okay. In 1979, I fell in love. I drank. Okay, in 1981, I had an affair with a married woman. I drank. In 1984, I had an affair with a married man. I drank. In 1985, I got pregnant. I drank. In 1990, I got promoted. I drank. In 1992, I fell in love again. I drank. In 1995, my heart got broken again. I drank. Do you get the theme here? I drank about everything. Everything. I didn't need a reason to drink. I loved to drink. And I'm going to tell you something. If I wasn't an alcoholic, I would drink every day. I love to drink. See, but I'm an alcoholic. I can't drink. Because I will suffer many consequences, and I have, due to my drinking. So, you know, I became a thief. I became a liar. I became a user. I became an abuser. I became things that I'm not proud of. Things that I don't like to talk about. But sometimes it's necessary that I say those things out loud to remind myself. And maybe for anyone who might be sitting out there that they're sitting in shame over the things that they did, I might be able to give you some freedom. So I'm going to speed it up to I was 17 years old, and I'm partying on the regular. And I graduated high school ahead of my class. I don't know how. I don't know why. And I was engaged to be married to a man. Now, remember, I kissed a girl at 11 and I drank. I kissed a boy at 12 and I drank. Now, I did enjoy kissing the girl much better than I did enjoy kissing the boy. So that I knew I was a lesbian. But I couldn't be with that. I didn't know what that was about. I was petrified of my sexuality. So, you know, I played the pretend game, and I got involved, and I had a boyfriend, and we got engaged at 17 years old. And my brother, 3 years older than myself, he was engaged to be married, and my mother got engaged to be remarried. So now we're all getting married. Like, could you imagine? This is great, in Brooklyn, in this six-family house, and everybody's getting married. So now my brother's going first. He gets married. He moves to Miami. And it's my mother. It's me. I'm coming up now. It's my turn. I'm getting married in June. And I don't know. I had, talk about a spiritual awakening. I had an awakening. I said, oh, shit, I can't do this. You know, and I said to my mother, I said, Ma, I can't marry this guy. And she says to me, I was waiting for that. I said, well, why didn't you tell me you had to figure that out on your own, honey? You know, so I broke off the engagement. His name was Paul. And now my mother says, well, what are you going to do? You know, because she's getting married. And she says, and she did talk that way. She goes, well, you know, I got a room where I'm going to move with Al if you want to live there. I said, you know, Ma, can we call the landlord? You know, if you're going to be leaving this apartment, maybe I can just take this apartment over. And she said, yeah, sure, we can do that. So we called the landlord, and he lived in New Jersey. He was an elderly gentleman named Chris, and he agreed. He said, yeah, sure. So I, in July, had my own apartment, and I turned 18 in September. So now I'm the only person with my own apartment. Now we left Brooklyn. Okay, I left Brooklyn. I went into Ridgewood, Queens. That's where this happened. I kind of skipped a little part in there, but we had kind of moved over to Ridgewood, Queens, which is borderline Brooklyn, Queens. And you know, so my mother, so I had my own apartment. And my rent was $175 a month. I had graduated from high school, and I got like the dream job, a floor girl in the garment industry. Like making $140 a week. I don't know if anybody knows what a floor girl is. It sounds glamorous. It's not. It's really a runner. You just run and get all the material for all the women who are getting paid by the piece for what they're sewing. So, you know, you just ran all day and just brought them their material. So it wasn't a glamorous job. So I had to kind of figure out how I was going to be able to party the way I wanted to. So I got a brainstorm because, you know, us alcoholics, we're very, very intelligent. And I got a brainstorm that I'm going to convert my apartment now into a nightclub. And I did that. There was a woman who lived across the street. Her name was Yolanda. I had no idea that she was a lesbian because, you got to remember, I still did not really grasp my sexuality. And I had no idea that she was a lesbian. And I got to talking to her one day and told her, you know, I got all this furniture. I want to convert my apartment. And she was, like, right on board. And she said, I'll come over on the weekend. And she came with power tools and a tool belt and, you know, and all of that. And I still had no idea that she was a lesbian. And, you know, we smashed, when I tell you, with sledgehammers, smashed every piece of furniture that was in my apartment and built new furniture with it. It was amazing that we did this. And then I had another friend who liked to sew, and she sewed quilts, and we made benches, and I painted every room black. I put Christmas lights around all the ceilings. I had another friend of mine who loved to do graffiti, and I asked her to graffiti one of the rooms, and I had a graffiti room. And there was one little tiny room off to the side, which was my bedroom, which was a mattress on the floor. And the door was closed. That was my bedroom where nobody was allowed in unless I invited you. And I charged admission into my apartment on the weekends. And I really thought that was a great idea, and it lasted for quite some time. It was really great. And I was the bomb jiggity, man. I had an apartment. You know, like, I had a lot of friends. Don't ask me their names today. I couldn't tell you, but I had a lot of friends. You know, that lasted for quite some time until the lady downstairs got a little tired of it. And she called the landlord and he came around and things had to change. So, you know, then, you know, let's get back into, when I went through my little years there of why I drank. You know, so I met a married man and it was perfect. He was married. I wasn't looking for anything, but I heard he was like, he liked to party. And he asked me out a couple of times. I met him at work, and he asked me out a couple of times. And I'd always say yes because I never knew how to say no. I never said no to anything. If you told me, listen, stick the joint in the whiskey, blow dry it with the hair dryer, and then line it with some Coke and smoke it, and you'll be... I did anything. I never said no to anything. So when he asked me out, of course I said yes. And then when it came to the time where we were going out, then I'd give him some bullshit story as to why I couldn't go. I got to go do laundry or whatever I might have made up. So now it was like the fourth time I did this, and I said, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I have to go out with this guy. I mean, you know, I can't keep just saying yes and then the day of, you know, calling it off. So I went out with him, and we're in his car, and you know, I'm he said, I have balls. Yes, I do. They're in the drawer at home. you know, I got in the car with him immediately. His name was Kenny. He was absolutely gorgeous. He was from Grenada. He was West Indian. He wore suits tailored, and he had an accent.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
He was gorgeous, and he had a bar in the back of his car, which even made him more gorgeous. We get in the car and we're driving, and I said to him, I want to let you know something. By now, I've grasped my sexuality, okay? And I said to him, I want to let you know something. I'm a lesbian. And he said, yeah, I heard that about you. And he said, I don't believe it. I said, well, what the hell, you don't believe it? And he said to me, you're too pretty. So, you know, he had that idea that, you know, all lesbians look like truck drivers. And So then after he said that to me, I said, well, you know, I heard you were married. And, you know, and he said, oh, you know, I'm married, but. Yeah, I don't have anybody he ever got the I'm married, but. We live in the same house. We don't sleep in the same bed. You know, that whole I'm married, but. And I really didn't care. You know, because they just wanted a party. And anyway, we winded up partying and hanging out and all of that. And we used to go out on a regular and party. He didn't do drugs. He drank a lot. I drank and drugged. But I will tell you, by the end of our relationship, he did a lot of drugs also. And inside of that relationship, I got pregnant. Now, I want to tell you, I don't know how that happened. I mean, I know physically how it happened. But I don't really know how it happened. But I got pregnant. And wasn't exactly in the plan. But anyway, I guess I had a relationship with my God, and I asked my God, you know, what do I do? Because there were some circumstances behind that I'm not going to get into, whether or not I should have had this baby. So I didn't know what to do. And I made a decision to have the child. He wasn't in agreement with it. Most of the people in my life were not in agreement with it, and I made a decision to have this baby. So I'd like to tell you now that I'm pregnant and I'm going to have a baby, I just stopped, you know, living that crazy life. I'd be lying to you if I told you that. I drank and drugged every single day for 9 months. And every single day I did that foxhole prayer. God, please, if you let this baby be okay, I promise you I will not do this again tomorrow. And those promises that I made were dead because I drank and drugged every day. Pregnant as could be to the drug dealer on Evergreen and Central in Bushwick, putting my money through the door to get my stuff. Okay, pregnant. And I'm not talking a little bit pregnant. I'm talking a lot of pregnant. Okay, and by the grace of God, I had a child who was just a low birth weight. She was fine. That's God. That's not me. And my daughter today is 30 years old, and she's an absolutely amazing woman. So now, that job that I had in the garment industry did not afford me to live the way I had become accustomed to living. It was just not paying me enough to support my drinking and my drugging and my partying. So I knew I had to get another job. So again, alcoholics, we're brilliant, right? So where do I get a job? In a bank. Right? So now, you know, money is just accessible to me. Like, this is great. I am fucking brilliant. So I get a job at a bank, and I accelerate. You know, like, I don't know why I accelerated in everything I did, but I accelerated. And, you know, within months, you know, I'm assistant to the head teller, and now I'm becoming the backup head teller, and now I'm the head teller. And I worked in a bank where we took in a lot more money than we paid out, so I had to pack up shipments for the Federal Reserve. And, on TV movies, when you see money in these big canvas bags with these, that's exactly how it is. So I used to be in the safe, high as a kite, packing up money for the Federal Reserve. So, you know, I mean, it was so much money. You know, and I couldn't imagine that with this much money, how could they possibly even notice if a little bit was missing? Like, there's no way they could notice. It would take them too long to count it. Like, who's really checking? So I began to take money. And, you know, and anybody who works, whoever worked in a bank, you know that you have an identification number that's linked to you, and everything you touch that has your number on it, you know, you put it through this validation machine. So I, again, I'm brilliant. I never took any of my own money. I mean, what would that look like? So, you know, and I'm really getting away with this, and that married woman that I was having an affair with, she was my boss. Yeah. So, you know, I hope those tapes that are in the vault never come out, because we didn't just count money. However, I will tell you that financial institutions are also very, very smart. And it didn't take long before they were on to me. And I don't know why they didn't come at me right away. They kind of let me go. You know, and they, you know, when you give someone a leash and then you give them a little more room, they take it. You know, so they were on to me, but they let me. So, you know, I just kept on. And by now I'm developing a really bad cocaine problem. You know, I got an alcohol problem. I got a woman problem. You know, I got, these things cost money. So, you know, long story short, I met the FBI. You know, and I'm going to tell you, it wasn't like I met them at Starbucks or something. I met them at, you know, One Federal Plaza. And I was going to jail. I'm telling you, I was going to jail. Like, are you kidding me? What? You know, I mean, I'm very brilliant. How did that happen? I mean, I would see if I came into the bank with a wool cap and a gun and robbed the bank. Like, of course I should go to jail for that. But, you know, this was an inside job. I mean, can we work something out? You know, and that didn't go over so well. And I'm going to tell you that, you know, I had no God in my life, but I'm going to tell you what, God had me. Because I'm going to tell you, I didn't go to jail. I had to make restitution for a couple of things. You know, because they didn't get me for everything. I don't know why they were so lenient on me. They got me for a few things, and I had 48 hours to make restitution. 48 hours. I didn't have a fucking dollar in my pocket. I got 48 hours to make restitution for thousands and thousands of dollars. Well, I'm going to tell you that I came up with the money. I'm not going to tell you how. That's for another meeting. But I'm going to tell you that I came up with the money. So, I made my restitution. I did my 48-hour time, and I left out of there, and I went to now One Chase Manhattan Plaza. I just gave away the financial institution that I worked for, and they told me now to go and fill out all my being released from employment papers. So I went to One Chase Manhattan Plaza, and I filled out all my release from employment papers. And I walked out of there with a check for $14,000. I said, what? See, while I was employed with them, I was putting money in savings bonds, and I was doing all kind of, you know, whatever they said here, sign up for this and that, and they had savings for me. So they gave me everything that was due me. So I make this restitution for $12,000, and I walk out of there with $14,000. Again. I'm fucking brilliant, right? So, you think that that would scare me. No, I'm going to tell you that that gave me a ticket to say, Kathy, cool has arrived. You can't mess with this. Okay, so I just continued. Now, I just continued on my journey like a lunatic. Okay, like a lunatic. And I had no idea that anything was wrong. So now I'm going to fast forward because I'm watching the time here. And, I told you I had a daughter. And now that I got the job I got after that job that I lost, the bank job, I just took a bullshit job because, you know, I had $14,000. That was a lot of money back in 1983. I tell you, I went through it in about 14 days. But, you know, it was a lot of money back in 1983. So I said, let me just get this bullshit job. So I got a job as a cashier in a supermarket down about a block and a half away from my house as a cashier. That was in 1983. I had my way of finagling some money out of the register. They weren't the most legit company, so they really kind of just turned the other cheek. And I'll have you know, it's 2015, it's 32 years later, and I'm still with that company. And I hold an executive position. Wow, this drunk, imagine that. So now I'm going to tell you that I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I attended my first meeting in 1996. Now I'm going to tell you how I got to my first meeting. A lady who lived next door to me, by now I moved back to Brooklyn, Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And there was a lady who lived next door to me, and her name was Michael Ann. Okay, and her life was unmanageable. Now, that was not the word that I used at the time. I understand now unmanageability. But at that time, I probably said, man, her life's fucked up. But she always had the best attitude. You know, and I would come smashed walking down the block. I mean, it was just so obvious. I really thought I had the secret that nobody knew that I was an alcoholic and an addict. So one day she says to me, listen, Friday night is my anniversary. Would you like to come? And I said, well, yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm thinking a party, right? So she tells me it's at St. Cecilia's Church at 8 o'clock. So I said, okay, great. So now Friday I come home from work and, you know, I have a few drinks. I'm getting ready. I'm going to the party. And, I get to St. Cecilia's Church. I see a lot of people outside. They're smoking. So I see these stairs. I go downstairs. There's balloons around. There's kind of like a podium like this. There's tables and chairs and balloons. And, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, we're at an anniversary. I'm wondering why, like, where's the alcohol? I figured it didn't get there yet. You know, so I'm looking around, like, I don't see any alcohol. I don't see any drinks. So the woman gets up and starts thanking people. And, you know, and I'm sitting out there like you're sitting out there. And I'm saying, I'm looking around because I knew her husband. I got high with him. And I'm looking around and I'm saying, why isn't her husband at their anniversary? I don't understand why he's not here. You know, and why is she having her anniversary at a church basement? You know, like I really, this is like, I'm clueless. So halfway through her talking, it hit me. This is an AA meeting. What the hell am I doing here? Well, let me tell you, I ran out of there so quick. I had to go home and have a drink. That was crazy. So, that was my first meeting. Anyway, I came back to AA in 1999, not because I wanted to. I'm not going to tell you I came here because I knew that I had a problem. I came here to put a Band-Aid on a situation. That's why I came here. So I came here in 1999, and by the grace of God, I haven't had the desire to go back out and drink. And I'll tell you, thank you. That's huge for this drunk, because I told you if I wasn't an alcoholic, I would drink every day, because I love just being out of myself. I had my last drink in 1999. In 2001, I found love again. I didn't drink. In 2005, I got promoted. I didn't drink. In 2007, that love that I found ended, that relationship. And I lost everything. I walked away with my clothes in a hefty garbage bag with nowhere to go. And by now, I'm 7 years sober. I didn't drink. In 2009, I got on a committee for a roundup. I didn't drink. That's a big one. In 2010, I got promoted again. I didn't drink. 2011, my grandson was born. I didn't drink. 2012, my mother died. I didn't drink. 2013, I got demoted. I didn't drink. 2015, my daughter graduates with her master's. I had nothing to do with that. I didn't drink. When I go back home Tuesday morning, I'm resigning from my job that I've been at for 32 years. Now, if anybody knows my employer, that stays in this room, okay? Because they don't know it yet. And here's what I'm going to tell you. I don't have another job. And I'm not going to drink. So now, do you get this theme? See, there was a theme before I got here that I drank for every reason. And the theme in my life today, I drank for no reason. I don't drink for no reason. So if there's anybody out there that's having a hard time, just stay. Stick with the winners. Stick with the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they told me in the beginning, don't leave before the miracle. But they don't frickin' tell you what the miracle is. So I can't leave. Now, you can live the kind of life where everything is a miracle. And that's the kind of life I live today. I have a miracle every single day. And if there's any one of you out there that don't think you have one, see me, because I will help you find your miracle. And in closing, I would just like to read something out of the big book. Because it's my favorite part. I bring my big book with me everywhere. And, you know, thank God for the people who came before us. Because there was a woman, Joanne, at the Green Steeple meeting when I first got there. And I'm going to tell you something. I was not the person who stands before you today. I don't even recognize that person anymore. And she gave me this big book. And it's to Kathy. Keep God in one hand and in your heart, and keep this book in your life, and you will be okay. Love, Joanne. And I have several big books. This is the big book I bring with me when I travel, because it's lightweight, it's paperback. And there's something else that's noted in this book, and it's on page 112. And it's the first three, and I invite you all to go check it out in your big book. Wipe the dust off your damn book and open it up. Okay? And it's on page 112. It's the first three words on page 112. I'm going to read them to you. The first three words on the page. Read this book. this is what I want to close with. Page 164, the last page of our program, the last paragraph. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God, as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. That's right, guys. Clean it up. Only you can. Give freely of what you find and join us. Be a member. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. I want you to know I chased fellowship of the Spirit in a bottle for 30 years. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. You know, and let me just tell you about trudge the road to happy destiny. Because if you look up the word trudge, trudge says laborious walk. I didn't like that. See, I got an opinion. So I then looked up trudge the road to happy destiny. The whole meaning changes. And trudge the road to happy destiny means to walk with purpose. Walk with purpose. Every single one of us has a contribution to make to this universe, to our fellows, and to this program. And I invite you all to take that on. May God bless you and keep you until then. I'm Kathy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Kathy. I'd also like to thank Quinn for reading There Is a Solution and an advanced Kristen for reading The Keys of the Kingdom. The AALA committee would like to thank everyone for attending our open AA meeting. Once again, let's thank Kathy for sharing her experience, dreams, and hope with us. And as a reminder, you can thank Kathy here at the front of the room after the closing prayer. In closing, I have asked Kristen to read The Keys of the Kingdom and afterwards ask everyone to make one large circle around the room and after a moment of silent meditation, lead us in the Serenity Prayer.
I'm Kristen, alcoholic. AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life. And the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We do not, cannot outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds. As we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line, for we find that we are more than compensated for a consistent effort by the countless dividends we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problem, we experience a thrill of challenge in the opportunity it affords for another application of AA techniques, and we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. After a moment of silence for the man and woman who are still suffering in and out of this program, please join me in the Serenity Prayer.
You have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.